right. Everybody ready at the other location? Super. So tonight we're going to talk about weapons of mass destruction, and for the first talk of the evening, it gives me great pleasure to have Rich Muller from the UC Berkeley Physics Department and also Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory here to speak about the physics of weapons of mass destruction. Rich has an incredible number of interests, all of them fascinating. He works on mass extinctions. He works on whether there's a distant companion of the sun. And I'm fairly sure that's a true understatement of his actual breadth. He also does a lot of national security work or consulting for the government. So he's thought about these issues a long time. And if you actually go to the site that the reader for tonight came from, you'll see a lot more of his work posted, and it's a very interesting read. I recommend it. So without further ado, Rich Muller.
Thank you. I'm supposed to talk about weapons of mass destruction. When you say weapons of mass destruction, you think nuclear weapons. And that's right. These days we're learning that you also think of biological weapons, particularly some sort of virus, some sort of bacteria, something that can spread from one person to another. Those are truly weapons of potential mass destruction. We've seen with Hiroshima and Nagasaki what nuclear weapons have done. We've seen through many tests what they can do. We have some experience of what biological outbreaks can do, from the plague, from the 1918 flu, and so on. No question but that those are potentially really horrible. We also lump in some other things, like chemical weapons. Those we have very little experience with. For some reason, they never really showed up. In Iraq, we were prepared for them. We were getting set to fight a chemical warfare situation in Iraq. It never happened. Chemical warfare is notorious because of its effect in World War I, when the Germans used it first. And some people argue that chemical really aren't weapons of mass destruction. They don't work in the same way that nuclear and biological work. They're unlikely to cause the same kind of hundreds of thousands of deaths that you can get from the others. My feeling on that is, I agree. Chemical weapons are the traditional weapon. We use chemicals for bombs. That's what they're made out of. Are they weapons of mass destruction? Well, we've seen Saddam Hussein use them in Iraq against his own people. They certainly killed hundreds, if not thousands, of people there. Was it really much worse than if he had used bombs? Well, let's put off that discussion for a while. The chemical weapons are lumped in with weapons of mass destruction, but I think it's largely an artifact of World War I. And the fact that it was our enemy who used them first, and so we were all horrified that he was poisoning our soldiers at the same time we were merely ripping his soldiers to shreds with explosives. What I'm going to emphasize today is nuclear, and I'm going to touch a little bit on bio, just because I have some interesting things to say on that. But the emphasis is going to be on nuclear. There are two types of weapons of mass destruction that are labeled nuclear. One of them is a nuclear bomb. There are three kinds of nuclear bombs. Well, there are many categories of nuclear bombs. Okay, let me not just say that there are three. But the two main kinds I will be talking about are fission bombs. Fission bombs are the sort of bomb that we used over Hiroshima, killing somewhere between 50,000 and 150,000 people. We don't really know. We used a fission bomb over Nagasaki to destroy a similar number of people in that. By the way, we in Tokyo, using chemical weapons, we killed an equal number of people. We started a firestorm over Tokyo. We started a firestorm in Dresden using chemical weapons. But these are traditional chemical weapons. These are bombs and incendiary bombs designed to start fires. So I don't want to forget bombs. Bombs and explosives and gasoline are something that I think we need to worry about every bit as much, maybe more so, than nuclear weapons. In fact, let me mention a few things as I'm starting right about 9/11. I don't know how many of you remember 9/11 the morning. I got a phone call from my sister, and she said, turn on the television, and there were the burning buildings. And we heard that an airplane had gone into them. At that time, just one. And the building was fiercely burning. And my wife said to me, how could they have gotten so many explosives on the airplane? And I said, well, they didn't bother. I said, undoubtedly, this is probably a transcontinental flight. And they had maybe 50 tons of airplane fuel. And airplane fuel has more energy than dynamite, more energy than high explosives. In fact, I had lectured my class on the previous week about the energy stored in fat, in gasoline, in TNT. So I had told them an interesting fact, that if you compare 1 pound of gasoline and the energy you can get out of that by combining it with the oxygen in the atmosphere, compared to the energy you get out of 1 pound of TNT, dynamite, the gasoline has 15 times more. We don't use dynamite because it has huge amounts of energy. We use dynamite because it can release it very suddenly and thereby break materials that require that sudden application of force. We can shatter materials with dynamite. But with gasoline, it has more energy. If you're going to do your destruction through fire, you're much better with gasoline. We do the same thing in the war in Afghanistan. You may remember there were these things called fuel-air explosives, and this was a horrible new weapon that we used. It was a terrifying weapon to the Taliban. You drop this explosion. You drop this thing from an airplane. It comes down in a parachute. And it's slowly dropping. Well, after the first one dropped, everybody knew what was coming, and they were terrified. Because what happens in a fuel-air explosive is you take a fuel such as gasoline. They don't actually use gasoline, but gasoline is typical. And as it's coming down the parachute, you have two explosions. The first one is you take this and you spread it out. You blow it up so the gasoline disperses in the air. Then you ignite it, and that's the second explosion. If you drop a ton of this, you'll get the equivalent of 15 tons of explosion because there's so much more energy in the gasoline than there is in that much high explosive. So terrorists will use explosives when they need to use explosives. If all they want to do is to burn a building or burn people, they're better off using gasoline. Better off. I hate to use that term. You use gasoline and you get more energy per pound. That way. This is what the 9/11 terrorists did. They didn't have to smuggle any explosives into the airplane. This is the way I like to think of the dangers of chemical warfare. They're using chemicals and to release energy. In fact, it was sort of interesting. We went on that morning, discussed it, and then I came in and I taught my class and I explained to them what happened. I think if you understand the physics, it was pretty clear. They didn't put explosives on. Why carry a pound of explosives when there's 50 tons of jet fuel, very similar to gasoline, on the plane already? That goes into a building, and the energy output will be enormous. How did they sneak weapons onto the airplane? That morning and later for my class, I told them they didn't sneak any weapons on. There's no need to. Anybody who had followed airplane hijacking knew that you didn't need a weapon to hijack. All you do is pretend you had one. We had learned over the decades that the best thing to do when someone wants to hijack your airplane is cooperate. This was policy. All the pilots knew this. Someone comes in and says, I have a gun in here, and I'm going to start shooting people unless you do what you say. The pilot says, where do you want to go? Cuba? We'll go to Cuba. This policy had worked. It had saved lives. It had saved property. The airplanes, they would land in Cuba, and then Fidel Castro would arrest them. and extradite them to the U.S. or put them in a Cuban jail. They begged to be extradited to the U.S., but instead they were put in Cuban jails. It worked really well. So the policy was, you don't have to have a gun. There was no failure of airport security. They brought in some legal knives, as near as we can tell, things that you're allowed to bring on airplanes back then. And they said, give me your airplane. And then they took control of the airplane and smashed it into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. So there were no laws broken in getting into the airplane. It was only when they took over. Well, this was, I think, the brilliance of what they did. I once spoke to one of our spooks, one of the guys in the CIA who operated over in foreign countries and sometimes had to do jobs where he had to steal things. He called it breaking the law of the foreign country at the request of the U.S. government. And he gave me a rule. He said, one of the things you don't do when you're doing this is break more than one law at a time. You don't, if you're going to go break into somebody's safe, don't speed on the way to his house. The 9/11 hijackers were smart in this way. They didn't break any laws until they went to the pilot and said, hand over your plane. Now, the laws changed. We no longer allow people to bring little knives on the plane. For a long time, we couldn't even bring toenail clippers on the plane. And a lot of that was somewhat irrelevant. After 9/11, all we needed was the change in policy, which took place on the morning of 9/11, that you don't hand over your airplane anymore to a hijacker. We didn't, but the explosives are something I worry about a lot today. And I'll get to nuclear in just a moment, but let me tell you what I worry about most. I worry about explosives and gasoline as the weapons of choice of the terrorists. It's the ones they have the most experience with, and they worked. They worked in 9/11. They were very effective. So what sort of things do I worry about? Well, we know that Osama bin Laden went after the World Trade Center twice. He's not going to go after it again, but he's likely to try the same sort of scenario again, an airplane to kill people. So I would worry about that a lot, about not hijacking an airplane necessarily. He could buy one and then fly it into a populated, well, maybe a football stadium or something like that. So I worry about that. A lot of people are watching out for that. You're not going to buy an airplane in the U.S. these days without having a lot of scrutiny. The other thing I worry about are explosives smuggled on airplanes. We know that Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, remember him? He was the guy who went past security smuggling in explosives in his shoe, and then he tried to ignite his shoe and blow a hole in the side of the airplane. And he kind of fumbled around in the fuse and gotten damp from his foot, and he couldn't get it lit. And he was jumped by the other passengers who stopped him from doing anything and went to trial. So he didn't get away with it, but he was trying to blow up an airplane. I this is another thing I worry about, smuggled explosives on airplanes. But I'm supposed to be talking about weapons of mass destruction. So let me get to nukes. Nuke. Nuke. Some people say that President Bush mispronounces nuclear. He should say nuclear, but he says nuclear, and a lot of people don't like that. Eisenhower said nuclear. Edward Teller said nuclear. He could say it any way he wants. Nuclear weapons take advantage of the fact that in a nucleus, here's an atom with a nucleus in it. And you've seen this. This has some protons in it. They have positive charge. Out here we have electrons moving in orbits. These days we tend to think of it more of a cloud of electrons moving around. This is basic physics. The scale here is fantastic if you think about it. Suppose you make this into a football stadium. Ask, how big is the nucleus? The answer is, well, somewhere between the size of a mosquito and the size of a fly. Think of that. Think how tiny this nucleus is in the vastness of the atom. It's really a very tiny target. It consists of a bunch of positive charges, and they're all repelling each other. Because the fact that it's so small, it gives us this enormous energy. Normal chemical energy comes from these electrons. But the nuclear energy comes when this proton blows itself apart. It happens randomly, or you can make it blow itself apart by hitting it with another particle called a neutron. When it blows itself apart like this, there are two nuclei that are particularly important. One of them is a nucleus called uranium-235. The other is the nucleus of plutonium-239. These are the key nuclei. These are the ones where we know if you hit it with a neutron, they will blow apart and release a great deal of energy. How does the energy get out? Well, these particles come flying out, and they have high velocity. They knock into the other atoms, give them some velocity until finally the whole thing is heated up. So what's happening in a nuclear explosion is a neutron comes in, these things fly apart, and they heat up the thing that they're in. If you want to have a nuclear explosion, you need a substantial fraction, you know, maybe 10% of the nuclei in a piece of uranium or a piece of plutonium to blow up in this way. That's done on the chain reaction. So in a chain reaction, what you do is you have a lot of nuclei, you have to have a large number. Because you see, these nuclei are tiny. I'm exaggerating their size here. They're really tiny. So you have to have this thing has to go on, in this scale, it would have to go on for miles. One of them blows up, and out comes a neutron, and the two fission fragments that create the energy. Okay. Let's see, I'm curious. Can everybody in the other location see this board okay? I see a picture of me.
Yeah.
I see the board. They can. Okay, good. If you have enough of this material out here, then this is likely to hit another nucleus. Miss that one, but maybe it'll hit this one. And then blow that apart. So you go from here you have the two fission fragments coming out with uranium-235. Typically, you have two neutrons coming out. If they both hit another nucleus, then you have, from one fission, now you have two fissions. And then four. 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512. Those of you who work with computers know these numbers. They're very familiar. How many times do you have to do that before you get up to a number like 10 to the 24th? Sort of the number of atoms in one mole of uranium. And the answer is about 80 times. And you could do that. It's sort of fun to do. Do it on a pocket calculator. 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2. And it's doubling each time. In fact, almost every three times you push the button, it goes up by a factor of 10, approximately. It's actually a factor of 8. So every three times you push the button, you go 10, then 100, then 1,000, then 10,000, 100,000, million, 10 million, getting up there really fast. After about 80, you're getting up to the numbers of atoms there are in a solid piece of uranium. We call that 80 generations. So the trick in a nuclear weapon is have enough material that these neutrons don't miss. They don't fly out. You have to have what's called a critical mass. And that's what a critical mass is. Critical mass is the amount of material it takes so the neutrons don't fly out. Now, normally if you want a critical mass of uranium, it's actually quite big. If you apply some tricks, you can get it smaller. You put a reflector around it. There are materials you can make that reflect neutrons. You can make it smaller. How small? Well, I don't even know the number myself. But you can look it up on the web, and you get various sites, some of which are probably more believable than others. The Federation of American Scientists says you can do it with about 25 kilograms of uranium. 25 kilograms would be about that much. It's pretty dense stuff. For plutonium, the answer is actually more interesting because that has been published by the Department of Energy. And the answer is 6 kilograms. So imagine this. You get 6 kilograms of plutonium. How much is 6 kilograms? How big is it? It fits in a coffee cup. you get 6 kilograms of plutonium, put them together into a coffee cup, and sooner or later, one of them will fission, out will come the neutrons, they'll be absorbed, they'll double, actually, in plutonium, it's tripling. Because every neutron, when it breaks apart one of the plutonium atoms, out come 3 neutrons on average. So it happens faster, maybe 50 generations. In fact, most of our fission weapons are based on plutonium. That's one of the reasons why. So here you get a coffee cup full of plutonium, and these fissions, these neutrons will come out, and they'll start releasing the energy in the nucleus. At first, 1 nucleus, then 3, then 9, then 27, then 3 times 27, then 3 times that, and so on. And after about 50 generations, you've released this energy. Now, how much energy is in that nucleus compared to the energy in the electron? The answer is about a factor of 200 million times as much. 200 million times as much. This was why people got excited about the basic idea of a nuclear explosion. Nuclear reactors try to do this, but they try to control it so that every neutron that comes out only on the average hits one other nucleus. Only one, not 3, just one. So once this thing gets going and you're generating a lot of energy, the energy doesn't grow anymore. It just keeps on coming out at a regular rate. That's the difference between a nuclear bomb and a nuclear reactor. Nuclear reactor, on average, there's no multiplication factor, it's just one. Nuclear bomb, you're trying to get this thing to multiply. An important little fact, there is a real danger in trying to make a nuclear bomb that it won't work. In fact, early in the Manhattan Project, the scientists concluded that with an ordinary design, with a gun-style design, which I'll talk about in a moment, that a plutonium bomb would not work. They needed an invention way around that. Let me show you how the uranium bomb worked. I'll draw a diagram of the uranium bomb that was used in. Let's see. How do I? Oops, wrong kind of pen. Okay, let's see if I can go there. The basic idea is this: if you have a piece of uranium that's smaller than the critical mass, that means so small that the neutrons, on average, don't double; they leak out. Take 2 of these and put them together and make a critical mass, all you have to do is bring them together. Well, you got to bring them together pretty fast. And the reason, if you bring them together slowly, you'll start getting the doubling. And you may go 30, 40 generations, and at this point you have as much energy as you have in an explosion. And the thing will simply heat up, turn to, and you'll get an explosion, and you'll never finish the explosion. So you have to bring them together pretty quickly. This was done in the Hiroshima bomb. By using a gun, a cannon. Now, I don't know the exact design inside of this cannon, but it's typically drawn, there's a diagram the Department of Energy releases that has it looking like this. They have a hemisphere over here and a hemisphere over here. Some people draw it as a pellet that goes in the side of this, but it doesn't really matter. And you put ordinary gunpowder or some other high explosive over here. You ignite it. Electronic fuse, not a real fuse. This thing gets thrown into this thing. It happens just enough. It gets over here. You have a critical mass. Usually they put a little device in here that'll start the neutrons going, and then this thing blows itself apart in a few microseconds, millionths of a second. That's all it is, just bringing the uranium together. How hard is it to design something like this? Well, this looks like an artillery gun. And you take the uranium and you shape it like that, and you put it in. Every now and then, some high school student will draw a picture like this and say, U-235 and U-235. Now, the Hiroshima bomb, they used a lot of uranium. It was something like 25 or... there are different numbers on how much it was in. I've heard numbers from 25 kilograms up to 50 kilograms. Exactly how much they used. So a high school kid will draw a picture like this, and then he'll say, I designed an atomic bomb, and he's kind of right. And they may even take it to someone at Livermore or someone who's really works a real bomb, and they ask him, will this work? And he'll say, yeah, that would work. Of course, you have to build it. You have to get a hold of this. You have to shape these things. You have to machine it. But I believe, and I think most experts would agree with me on this, that if a terrorist organization got a hold of 50 kilograms of uranium-235. This is not ordinary uranium you dig out of the ground. This is purified uranium. It's very hard to purify. But if you get a hold of this, could they, in one of their camps, get a team together, get a hold of one of these cannons, artillery, shape these things, put them together, and make a workable nuclear weapon? Most experts, not all of them, but most experts would say, yes, they could do that. The hard thing in getting a uranium bomb is getting the uranium. It turns out this uranium-235 is not easy to get. It's not easy to make. And I will argue, and again, most experts will agree with me, that Al-Qaeda or another well-financed, highly intelligent, maybe even with some physicists working on it, terrorist organization could not succeed in separating out the uranium-235 from ordinary uranium. That's a much harder technology. So, by the way, if any of you saw this film last night called Last Best Chance, you'll notice that the terrorist organization was not purifying uranium. What they were doing was stealing uranium or buying it from various people who had purified uranium. Purifying uranium is hard to do. We did it in World War II by using a device called a calutron. Let's see. I've got a clean sheet here. A calutron is a device in which you take the uranium, you vaporize it, you charge it, put it through a magnetic field, and the two isotopes of uranium will separate. I don't need to go into a great deal of detail on this, but say it took the United States many, many months using this method to separate enough uranium to use in the Hiroshima bomb. The bomb was never tested. That's a lot of people surprised. They said, but wait, wasn't there a bomb test in Alamogordo out in New Mexico? Yeah, but that was a plutonium bomb. A uranium bomb is easy to make if you have uranium-235. But uranium-235 is hard to get. In World War II, the Manhattan Project managed to get enough uranium-235 using the calutron. It was named after my university, Cal, by Lawrence, who did it. Calutron, California Uranium Tron. I guess. Named it after Cal. First one was designed here. They were finally built at Oak Ridge. There's a whole line of them still at Oak Ridge. They've been mothballed now. They're not being used anymore. And these, it may have been as long as a year, managed to separate enough uranium for one bomb. It was never tested. Why was it never tested? Because that gun design is going to work. It's not a very hard design. And so what they did is they got the uranium, they built this one bomb. And when it was available, they flew it over Hiroshima, dropped it. They had a radar fuse that could tell when it was about half a mile from the ground. They wanted to blow it up in the air just to get the maximum destruction. You don't want it on the ground. The air was much more damaging. And it created a firestorm, killed a lot of people. The blast, the heat, the firestorm killed somewhere between 50 and 150,000 people. Some people are surprised there's also the radioactivity of the bomb. And there's an interesting number here that I think you should know about. It was recently revised upward. The question is, what fraction of people who died from the nuclear weapon at Hiroshima died from radiation-induced cancer? Just think for a moment. What number do you think it is? What fraction of the people died from radiation-induced cancer? The answer is about 1.5%. Why so few? Well, the real answer is because they were all killed by the blast. It's hard to give someone enough cancer to kill them. There are a couple of numbers that... Okay, I should get back to cancer in a moment, but let me just say that if I give you, we measure cancer dose in a unit called the REM, R-E-M, for the sense of Roentgen equivalent man, but if you give someone 300 REM, there's a 50% chance that they will die from radiation poisoning, radiation illness. You want to know what radiation illness is? If you know anybody who's suffering from cancer and has undergone chemotherapy or radiation therapy, and you see how miserable they are, they're nauseated, their hair falls out, listless, it's a miserable thing to have to go through, that's the symptoms of radiation poisoning. At 300 REM, that's the LD50, which stands for lethal dose, at which 50% of the people will die. Some of them will die quickly, some of them will take weeks to die. That's at 300 REM. How many REM does it take to cause cancer? Well, the best number is that per cancer, you require 2500 REM. This number is disputed a little bit, but that's sort of in the middle of what people believe. That's to cause a cancer. So how do you cause cancer using radioactivity? You're going to kill them first. And it's true. It's very hard to give a cancer from radioactivity. But there's good evidence to think that if you take that 2,500 REM and divide it by 2,500 people, so you only get one REM per person, then you have 2,500 people, each one of whom gets one REM, there will be one extra cancer. This is what's called the linear hypothesis. It's called the linear hypothesis because we don't know that it's true. And the reason we don't know it's true is that 20% of people die of cancer anyway. Now we're talking here about 1 in 2,500. You have 2,500 people, you're going to get 500 people dying of cancer. And now, according to the linear hypothesis, you get one extra one. I mean, the bottom line is it's very hard to give people cancer using radioactivity. If you take a look at Chernobyl and you look at something like 7% of the radioactivity in that nuclear reactor was released when the reactor exploded and burned into the atmosphere, it spread all over the Ukraine and into Europe. And people estimate that of the roughly 10 million people that were exposed, 10 million people exposed, that there will be additional cancer deaths from Chernobyl. Approximately, it depends on who does the calculation, but again, I'll give you sort of reasonable numbers, about 24,000 cancers. That's pretty horrible. 24,000 cancers caused by this accident in which nuclear radioactivity was released. Really, really awful. Will we be able to identify a single person who gets cancer from Chernobyl? The answer turns out to be yes, because there are very few thyroid cancers in the vicinity of Chernobyl, and some of these cancers are thyroid cancers, so almost all the thyroid cancers are due to this. Now, thyroid cancers are curable. You treat them, and nobody is, the people who've gotten thyroid cancer, none of them have died. Well, what about the people who died of cancer? Well, the problem is, of these 10 million people, about 20% of them, which means 2 million, will die of cancer. In addition to the 2 million who normally die of cancer, there'll be an additional 24,000. Can we see that? Can we detect the 24,000? Statistically, no, because there's just too many variables and too many differences among the people. So the irony is, and this is a paradox, I don't know how to handle it, but it's worthwhile knowing, because this is important when we get to the issue of radiological weapons. It's very hard to give people cancer with radioactivity and know that you've done it. So here we have a 1% increase in the number of cancers due to Chernobyl, very hard to measure statistically. People who have been exposed to the radioactivity and get cancer will probably think they came from the radioactivity. That's in part because in our society, we don't like to publicize it when we're dying of cancer. We like to hide that fact. We're somehow ashamed of dying of cancer. So a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that 1/5 of us die of cancer. And so when you get cancer, you figure it's a rare disease. It isn't rare. It's one of the most common ways of dying. And it must be due to the reactor. So there's a paradox here. We won't be able to see these 24,000, but they're probably there. 24,000 people are 24,000 people. But it's statistically not observable. There's a paradox there that would come in when we get to radiological weapons. Anyway, this is all building on the fact that very few people from a nuclear explosion from Hiroshima died of cancer. It will be different with what's called a thermonuclear bomb. With a thermonuclear bomb, there is fallout, and that fallout could have a big effect. But we're not there yet. So let's get back here to talking about the effects of the nuclear weapon. If you watch this fascinating movie, Our Last Best Chance, they talked about a bomb similar in size to the Hiroshima bomb. They had an image of it landing in Chicago and showing the area which it would destroy. And it was a fairly accurate depiction, except when they talked about the fallout, it really wasn't that much fallout from Hiroshima. Fallout comes with a bigger bomb. So let's get back to the different kinds of bombs now. Okay. We're talking about the uranium bomb. Mentioned the fact that if you can get the material, you can make a bomb. How do you get the material? There are several technologies to do this. The first technology I mentioned was the calutron. That was a quickie way of doing it. As soon as we got the first bomb, there was never more than one bomb made out of calutron uranium. Subsequent bombs used after World War II was over were made by using uranium diffusion. In uranium diffusion, what you do is you take uranium, you combine it with fluorine, you make uranium hexafluoride gas. You don't have to heat it very much. It's a gas at relatively low temperatures. And then you diffuse it. You put it through these membranes. The membranes were made out of an exotic material. And the exotic material isn't exotic anymore. It's called Teflon. But by diffusing this, the facilities to do this are huge. And the one in Oak Ridge is something like a mile. The buildings that do this are like the area of these buildings, I think, is something like a half. Oh, look at that. Glad it's still on your page. I lost it on mine. Let's see if I go back. I got Google here. So let me try going back here to this. And there we are. I got it. Okay, these buildings are like a quarter mile in size. They're huge buildings. And most of the uranium that we use for subsequent bombs came from diffusion, because this we could do. Also, we use this to purify uranium for our nuclear reactors. So this is called diffusion. And Russia has done it using diffusion. China has done it using diffusion. This is a huge thing. We're talking about $1 billion of effort here. Large area. You really can't miss it. But there are other ways to purify uranium. Now, why do we need to purify it? Ordinary uranium ore, consists of 99.3% uranium-238. We need to get fairly pure uranium-235. That's 0.7%. So getting rid of this is the hard part. Now, there are new modern ways to do this. There's been some development of using laser technology. But the way of choice these days is to use a centrifuge. A centrifuge is simply a tube that you spin very high speeds. You put the gas inside of this, and the heavier material will spin to the outside. And you scoop it off. These things move very fast. They're typically not very big, less, you know, maybe 1 or 2 feet in diameter. And they're spinning with the surface moving very fast, something like a kilometer per second. And the gas is put inside. The heavier gas goes to the outside. That's the uranium-238. The lighter gas stays on the inside, and that's scooped out. So this is called a centrifuge. And if you read the newspapers, you'll hear a lot about gas centrifuges. The problem with gas centrifuges is you can put them in a relatively small room, not much bigger than any of these rooms we see that I'm looking at on the screen. The room you're in right now, somewhat bigger, but maybe 2 or 3 times bigger. You put these gas centrifuges in them. It doesn't take much power. And you can start separating uranium-235. This is what we worry about for places like North Korea, This is what we accused Saddam Hussein of doing when he was buying high-quality tubes. He claimed he was using them for artillery. We were worried that he was using them for centrifuges. Centrifuges don't take much power, they don't take much space, and they're very quiet. They don't make much noise. It's the technology of choice today. They're developing, as I mentioned, they're developing centrifuge technology in North Korea. It was exported from Pakistan. It's being used in Iran. Could Al-Qaeda put together a centrifuge plant? No, nobody really thinks they could. This is a small country can do it, but a big terrorist organization could not pull this off, we believe. That's not really the danger. In fact, there's no technology that we think is realistic where Al-Qaeda could be separating out uranium. The most likely way they'd get uranium is by buying it. If you consider how much Saddam Hussein spent on his Calutron project, the number's up in the billions, in order to get maybe 60 kilograms of uranium, he had used these. People forget that Saddam Hussein really did have a nuclear program. We recall that we expected there to be a nuclear program when we went in 2001 and haven't found anything. But back in 1991, after the first Iraq war, we found his nuclear program. He had separated uranium-235, hadn't gotten it up to the purity needed for a bomb yet. But he had these calutrons designed to do that. The calutrons. So, if you want to get uranium-235, and you can't build a centrifuge plant, what you do is you try to buy some. And at the price that Saddam Hussein had spent, billions of dollars for 60 kilograms, it means that this stuff, to him, was more valuable than gem-quality diamonds. That was the price he was paying. Imagine 60 kilograms of the best quality diamonds you can get. That's billions of dollars. And he was willing to spend more than that to get the uranium because he just wanted it. Just one bomb. If he had just one bomb, what he could do with it. He didn't get that one bomb. But there is purified uranium out there. We have it in the U.S. pretty well secured. In the former Soviet Union, there's been a major effort to try to account for every gram of uranium-235. There are other places where uranium-235 is used. Have we all accounted for it? To most people's satisfaction, no. Although certainly a lot better than it was a few years ago. This film that was just released, our last best chance, the terrorists get the uranium-235 from scientists and from guards at weapons laboratories where they get a hold of the uranium-235. The other thing you can do for a uranium-235 bomb is steal a weapon. So, bottom line in uranium-235. You could make uranium-235 bomb if only you could get a hold of that stuff. That stuff is very hard to get a hold of. You have to steal it or buy it, or you're not going to make it yourself if you're a terrorist group. If you're in North Korea, you can do it. But even they have probably not succeeded in doing it yet. They're in the process of building it, and they're worried. They're probably doing it underground for fear that someone will choose to bomb their facility. These things are very quiet and very small, but they're also very fragile. What about plutonium? Okay, let's talk about plutonium. Plutonium, like uranium, you bring it together to make a critical mass, only 6 kilograms, that's the cup of uranium, that's all you need. But there's a problem with uranium, with plutonium. It's produced in nuclear reactors. In nuclear reactors, it's typically contaminated with another isotope called plutonium-240. These are details you don't really have to know. But with that contamination, it turns out that the ordinary gun design doesn't work. For a whole bunch of technical reasons, they decided in the Manhattan Project that you would need to implode the plutonium. You'd need to take your plutonium and put an explosion around the outside of it that would compress this, would compress it to the point where when things are compressed, the atoms get closer together. And so a neutron that would normally leak through cannot leak out when you compress it. So if you start with something like this, with the 6 kilograms spread out, and then you compress it, it wasn't a critical mass before, and now it is. That's a little misnomer calling it a critical mass, because the critical mass depends on the geometry, depends on how much you've compressed it. This was the one real secret of a plutonium bomb in World War II. You had to implode it. Well, you put explosive all around it, and of course the explosive explodes out. But an explosion is basically the turning of a solid into a gas, into a high-temperature gas. And then the gas expands, and that's what the explosion is. That's all an explosion really is. The expansion will push the plutonium in and compress it and turn it into a critical mass. And at that point, you get the nuclear explosion. So in a plutonium bomb, you have this explosive material outside. How do you make an explosive that will uniformly come in and compress this thing? If you want to imagine it, imagine taking a water balloon, fill a balloon full of water, imagine squeezing it with your fingers to compress it. You know, it tends to bulge out in between the fingers. Here, if there's one little part that isn't blowing in perfectly uniformly, it will bulge out and you'll never get the compressor. I've been to the machine shops in Los Alamos where they have made these things. I mean, you have this high explosive and you're machining it. What if it goes off? Well, that's why they had the machinist a quarter mile away, doing it via television. They have other tricks. They have what are called explosive lenses, where you have an explosive with different explosive propagation velocity, so that you can focus this thing on the sphere, because you can't detonate it everywhere. You have to detonate it only at given places. If you look at the picture of the Nagasaki bomb, or of the Alamogordo bomb. This thing was so uncertain that they decided they had to test it. They couldn't be sure it would work. I mean, they could test the explosions, and they thought it was working okay. They put it all together, they put it on the tower at Alamogordo, and they blew it up, and it worked, and that was the first atomic bomb. And you can go out to the test site, and you can see the tower that was smashed against the ground. Anyway, the shape of the bomb was not cannon-like. The cannon-like bomb was a Hiroshima bomb. It was round. It's called Fat Man. They gave it that name, Fat Man. Because of its round shape, it was an implosion bomb. Implosions are very, very difficult to do. Al-Qaeda could build a cannon with uranium-235 if they can get the uranium-235. Al-Qaeda could... Your plutonium's easier to get. Plutonium comes out of nuclear reactors. Many countries around the world have nuclear reactors. The IAEA inspects these to make sure no plutonium is being diverted. But compared to uranium, the technology is much simpler. You just need a nuclear reactor. And then you need what's called reprocessing. So you get the plutonium through reprocessing. That's because plutonium is produced in a nuclear reactor. It actually comes about when those neutrons... In a nuclear reactor, remember, only one neutron is supposed to go and make another fission. You don't want it doubling, because that's a bomb. So every time you have a fission, you get one neutron coming out that fissions. Where does the other go? Well, there are many places it could go. It could leak out. It could get absorbed on the water or on a control rod. Or it could hit the uranium-238. The neutrons hitting the uranium-238 tend to make plutonium-239. So the plutonium is manufactured in a reactor. Nuclear reactors in World War II, we manufactured the plutonium, separated it out chemically. You could do this chemically. You don't need a calutron, you don't need a centrifuge, because plutonium is different chemically from uranium. So you could separate it out chemically, you get the plutonium, you make a bomb, but it has to be an implosion bomb. So here's the bottom line. Two types of nuclear weapons. The first one is a uranium bomb. Very difficult to get pure uranium-235. If you get it, not so hard to make a bomb. Plutonium, relatively easy. You still need a nuclear reactor or access to someone who has one. The plutonium is not as well guarded as the uranium, but once you get it, it's very hard to make a bomb out of. The Alamogordo test in New Mexico, 1945, was a test of this. It had a yield, I believe, of 20 kilotons of TNT. That's 20,000 times as much as an equal, as 20,000 times. It's the same as if 20,000 tons of TNT had exploded. Very hard to make the bomb. So what is Al-Qaeda going to do? There's no easy way to do this. Well, you could steal a bomb. You could buy a bomb. And that's actually my greatest worry. Yes, it's possible that they could get some uranium-235. That was one of the main things they did in The Last Great Hope, in the movie. Then they could do it. It's possible. But the far more likely thing is that either they will... if they get a hold of plutonium, I don't think they're going to make a bomb out of it, unless the bomb is already made. They could steal the bomb. So here are the things I worry about. You could them stealing uranium-235 or stealing a plutonium bomb. As I mentioned, the bomb at Alamogordo was 20 kilotons. That was tested shortly after the uranium bomb. The gun design was dropped over Hiroshima, and it exploded with a explosive yield of about 13 kilotons of TNT. The next day, President Truman announced that Hiroshima had been destroyed with a bomb yield of 20 kilotons of TNT. Right, he got the number wrong. He was confusing it with Alamogordo. In fact, the number hadn't come back yet from Hiroshima because my thesis advisor, who measured it, he was in the chase plane over Hiroshima, had his measurements, but he hadn't gotten them back yet. And so Truman related the wrong number. Then about 6 days later, the first plutonium bomb was exploding in anger. And that was this one of these implosion bombs. And that was done over Nagasaki. We haven't used a bomb in anger since then. But we have developed bigger bombs. So let me talk about thermonuclear. I always get nervous when talking about thermonuclear. And the reason is, what I'm about to tell you was highly classified until around 1995. And I still get nervous about saying it out loud. You can look in the old books, and they all have designs and the secrets of the hydrogen bomb. It's worthwhile doing that, looking at old books. Some of you may have had this as a hobby when you were a kid. You know, look up and find the secret. You know, what's the big deal with the secret of the hydrogen bomb? Everybody knows it. It's in half a dozen books. Well, turns out it wasn't. Whatever been called the secret of the hydrogen bomb and published in these books and saying, ha ha, see, we can publish the secret, turned out to be the wrong secret. Wasn't the secret at all. So when you hear people telling you about the secrets and nobody in the government saying anything, doesn't mean they got it right. This is the way it works. This is a thermonuclear bomb. So the bombs I've mentioned so far are the fission bombs. Those were called by Truman an atomic bomb. Some physicists object to that because the atom, hey, you know, dynamite, that's atomic. This is using the nucleus. So you can call it a nuclear bomb. Or, if you prefer, a nuclear bomb. And there were two types, the uranium-235 and the plutonium-239. And they have all these things that you now know about. After this took place, there was the idea, being pushed largely by Edward Teller, of coming up with a super bomb. And I'm not going to go into the history of that. There are great books you can read about this, mostly the books by Richard Rhodes, R-H-O-D-E-S. He's written the definitive books on the making of the atomic bomb and on something he called Dark Sun, which is the story of the next kind, the super that worked. And it has various names. It's called the hydrogen bomb. Physicists often refer to it as the thermonuclear. Many people at the weapons labs, having learned from Edward Teller, refer to it as the thermonuclear bomb. This is a bomb that's typically could be, isn't, usually isn't actually, but got up to more than 3 million times as much as the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. 3,000 times as much. 3,000 times. We're talking here, these things were typically 13 to 20 kilotons. 1,000 tons. Here, the biggest bomb exploded was greater than 60 megatons. So that's 3,000 times bigger. The way it works, which I can now tell you, is that you have a case. The case is usually made out of a heavy material. Sometimes they use uranium. Over here, you have your fission bomb. And over here, you have some material that either is or will soon turn into tritium, which is a kind of hydrogen. This is tritium and deuterium. Actually, these things are usually made out of something called lithium-6 deuteride. And the deuterium is an isotope of hydrogen. It's called heavy hydrogen. Make heavy water. It's an ordinary hydrogen, but the nucleus is twice as heavy. It has an extra neutron in it. Tritium is ordinary hydrogen, but has two extra neutrons in it. It's called, well, doubly heavy water if it's made in water. Here it's not. It's combined with lithium. But in the nuclear explosion, this lithium is converted to helium and tritium. And so you make the tritium in real time, combines with the deuterium, is compressed and heated, and then it undergoes fusion. So this is sometimes called a fusion bomb. Fusion is a nuclear reaction in which the atoms, instead of splitting apart into two big pieces, come together and some small pieces come out, alpha particles come out. And these small pieces will carry the energy of the fusion. If you compress and heat tritium and deuterium mixture enough, you will get this thermonuclear explosion. You can make this as big as you want. And as it's made thousands of times bigger than this bomb here. But what explodes it is, as this bomb comes over, it emits radiation. And that radiation is what comes over it. The radiation travels at the speed of light. It's gamma rays. And so this bomb has to go off before the atom bomb explosion blows the thing apart. Not at all obvious that this will work. In fact, the design of this is very, very tricky. Several countries have managed to do this. Usually they get their very top physicists, chemists, engineers to work on something like this. They do extensive testing. Our main designers for this are at Livermore in Los Alamos. Very hard to make this thing work. You basically have to have this thing be imploded before this thing blows it apart. You have to have this in the first place. Is there any danger that Al-Qaeda is going to develop a thermonuclear weapon? No. Don't worry about that. Look, they could do enough if they could get a uranium bomb. They were talking about thousands of tons. Most of the discussions of a terrorist nuclear weapon has to do with just a plain fission bomb, an atomic bomb, a nuclear bomb, but not the thermonuclear, not the hydrogen bomb. This is very difficult to do. It was developed independently in the U.S. and in the Soviet Union. U.S. and the Soviet Union. A few other countries have developed it, but it's extremely difficult. And it's a technology that is much harder than any others. They designed the fission bombs in the Manhattan Project. Took many years afterwards to make this work okay. We use our best computers in trying to design these kinds of bombs. So that's the thermonuclear bomb, and not a real terrorist threat.
Question.
It is, however, the thermonuclear bomb. Is there a question?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I just want to ask, the hydrogen bomb that was made and tested in the U.S., was that ever made into a weaponized form, or was that just a stationary bomb?
Oh, the original hydrogen bomb actually had liquid deuterium and tritium in here. That was the size of a house. That kind of bomb was never developed into a real weapon. But when they replaced the tritium, the liquid tritium and liquid deuterium with lithium deuteride, they were able to make it into a small compact weapon. And in fact, our missiles, our intercontinental ballistic missiles, all carry thermal nuclear weapons. They all carry this design. Our missiles, by the way, will typically carry several of these, 4, 8, and will, while they're in orbit, they will drop them at different sites. But these things have become quite small now. You know, one of these weapons might be not much bigger than iron. It's worthwhile going to the unclassified museums at Livermore and Los Alamos. And is there one in Livermore? There is one. There is. Okay. And you get to see these weapons. You get to see a full-scale mock-up of the Hiroshima bomb. And you say, my God, that's so small. A full-scale mock-up of the Nagasaki bomb, the rounder one. And you look at that and you realize, here's this thing, this big, and it destroyed the city. And then you go see the thermonuclear bombs, which are no bigger than I am. And these are 3,000 times more destructive. These are also the ones that can create fallout, which is the true danger of radioactivity from a nuclear weapon. So let me talk a little bit about fallout, just so that you'll know this is not a terrorist danger. Fallout typically comes because when the atom, when the nucleus breaks into two parts, those two parts are typically radioactive. And most of the dangerous radioactivity from a nuclear weapon comes from those pieces. They're called fission fragments. And they are radioactive. Now, normally, they're kept in the vicinity of the bomb. If the bomb is exploding in the air, those fission fragments are up in the air. And they're in part of a hot gas. That air will float. Some of it may get down to the ground, but generally speaking, if you explode it in the air, it's not that big of a problem. The real danger from fallout comes if you explode it close to the ground. Now, all of this radioactive particles will be entrained in the big fireball, which when it rises, creates the famous mushroom cloud. But now you have a lot of dirt in here, mixed in because it was near the ground. And that dirt tends to have be made out of particles, and the radioactive fission fragments stick to that dirt, and they fall out. That's what gives rise to fallout. Now, some of the fission fragments don't live very long. Some of them, for example, iodine-131 is one of the fission fragments. It lasts, I believe, something like 8 hours, if I remember that correctly. So, but these things are falling out. That's one of the most radioactive components. If you're downstream here, where the wind is blowing this way, and this stuff falls out, you're very likely to die of radiation illness. So in the 1950s, we had fallout shelters. And fallout shelters were basically, you get inside the building, into one remote corner of the building, and you have enough food and water there to sort of last for until most of the fission fragments, the radioactivity would go away. Because the half-life being 8 hours, you know, 16 hours, that's only a quarter left. Another 8 hours, only half of that. After a few days, there's not much iodine-131 left. There are some other long-lived ones, like strontium-90, which lasts 30 years. But the iodine-131, which is the most intense, it's most intense because it's the one that's decaying fastest, that goes away relatively quickly. Sometimes they give iodine pills. And the idea is that the iodine will concentrate in your thyroid if you breathe it in or ingest it. If you take an iodine pill and saturate your thyroid with iodine, then the thyroid doesn't take up anymore. And so it will protect your thyroid against additional take-up of iodine-131. But there's still a lot of radioactivity, radiation illness. And if you get a big, you know, if enough people are exposed, then you'll get the cancer deaths. But you have to survive the radiation illness. At 300 rem, let's say you get 250 rem. And that's like a 40% chance of dying immediately. So you're a 60% survivor. What happens to your chance of cancer? You divide that by 2,500, and you find that it is 1 in 10. Did I do that right? Yeah, 1 in 10. So now your chance of, if you just barely survived, your chance of cancer has gone up from 10% to 30%. I mean, from 20% to 30%. If you just barely survived the radiation illness. At lower doses, the chance of cancer goes down very rapidly. If it's instead of 250 rem, it's 25 rem, and it's a 1%. So this is a danger, but for a small bomb such as Hiroshima, there just wasn't very much fallout. These are mostly from big bombs that are close to the ground, and the close to the ground means that the radioactivity comes down to the ground before it decays away. Now, the strontium-90 will eventually come down. It has too long a half-life. But the short-lived ones, the ones that give the most intense radioactivity, will you don't want them to fall out. You want them to stay up there in the sky. So thermonuclear bombs, don't worry about it for terrorism. What about radiological weapons? Let's get now to the radiological weapons. Radiological weapons are called weapons of mass destruction by law. In one of my articles, I cite the law. It was passed by the Congress. The 1997 National Defense Authorization Act says weapon of mass destruction. Now, there are some stories about radiological weapons. The Chechenian rebels got a hold of some radioactive material that was used for medical purposes. They gathered it together and put it next to a piece of dynamite. They then buried this in a park in Moscow. And then they did what they needed to do to maximize the terror impact of that weapon. They notified the newspaper where it was and how to dig it up. The newspaper went, found it, dug it up, verified this radioactivity was there, and that way did the maximum in spreading terror. What would have happened if instead of doing that, they'd actually blown it up? Well, there wasn't really enough radiation there. Once you spread it out, the radiation level gets below the 300 rem, you get below 100 rem, you don't get radiation illness at all. Unlike cancer, you get below 100 rem, 300 rem, half the people die. At 600 rem, essentially all of them die. At 100 rem, almost nobody dies. 50 rem, nobody. Your body recovers. The radiation, which is destroying the enzymes in your body, as well as mutating the DNA, if you only destroy a certain level of enzymes, your body recovers as it does from an illness. So at low levels, you don't get. If you're at 1 rem instead of 300, you don't get 1 in 300 getting radiation illness. You get nobody. But cancer doesn't work that way. At least we don't think it works that way. We think if you get a low dose of radiation, it can still induce cancer. If you have 1 rem, you're not going to get radiation illness, but you have one chance in 2,500 of getting cancer. So the idea is you could have a radiological weapon. The radiological weapon could be something that will cause radiation illness. Those are really tough. I mean, for one, you've got to get it there. So you might cover it with lead. You need several centimeters of lead to stop the radiation from gamma rays. And so this thing becomes very heavy. And then you have to expose it somehow. If you get another source. The story is it happened in Goiânia, Brazil. Look up this word on Google, and you won't find any false hits. Where there was a relatively hot cesium-137, had been used in a hospital. And it had somehow gotten dumped in a vacant lot. Some of the pieces of this had gotten picked up. 5 people died. Some people had brought the thing home, pieces of it home. 5 people died of radiation illness. If it had been spread out, if instead of being in one place, and if the people hadn't taken it home and brought it home with them, if they had been, let's say, 10 meters from it, they would not have gotten radiation illness. They would have gotten some increased chance of cancer. Now, at this point, that's the key thing I want you to know. These are important numbers. Know that 300 rem is the LD50 for radiation illness. But 2,500 rem equals 1 cancer. Those are useful numbers in case you ever get REMs. You know, you get a tooth x-ray, and if you ask the doctor what it is, they'll tell you it's less than 1 millirem. 1 millirem is 1/1000th of a rem, and that's only to the tooth. You had a question?
When you write 1 cancer, is that the LD100, the 100% chance?
No, this is the average. There's no such thing as a 100% chance. What it means is the belief is on the linear hypothesis, if you spread 2,500 rem over 2,500 people, there will be 1 extra cancer. There'll be fluctuations, there'll be 2 or 0, but it's not the same thing as LD50. And this is only approximately. There's some people who argue it's lower. The best data on this actually comes not for 1 rem doses, but for 10 to 50 rem doses from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The hardest thing is to estimate how much dose they really got. So Here's the problem with a radiological weapon, and one of my articles I wrote about this, and just appreciate it. If you have it really intense, it's very hard to get there, very, very strong, and you have to be close to it. If you get further away, you drop down below that radiation illness. If you spread this out over, I have some numbers in my article, and I work them out and have them here. If you take a source such as the one at Guyana, and you spread it out over a kilometer, then someone who stays in that kilometer for 24 hours a day in 1 year will get 140 rem. That's assuming no cleanup. That you have a radiological weapon, let's imagine it's being used in I don't know, San Francisco. And the radiation is spread out over kilometers, so there's 1 square kilometer that is contaminated. And it had this huge level that you had in Guyana. Of course, you could try more. But let's just work with that number, because this is the one that causes a great deal of fear. It would be 140 rem if you were there for a year. So what's your chance of getting cancer? It's quite large. 140 divided by 2,500, and that's about, well, let's call this 28. And then it's 1 in 20. So your chance of cancer is going from 20% to 25%. If you live in that area for a year, if the rain doesn't wash the radioactivity away, and you spend 24 hours a day there, and there's no cleanup, your chance of cancer goes up from 20 to 25%. Is this a viable weapon? Well, yeah, especially given the fact that people are really afraid of radioactivity. If I were in charge of Al-Qaeda, is this the weapon I would choose? No, I wouldn't pick this one. And no dead bodies. Well, maybe a few, you know, 3 or 4. But all we're doing is saying you have a greater chance of cancer. And it's very disruptive to the people who are exposed. They would move out so that their chance of cancer, instead of being 1 in 20, would be 1 in, well, let's say you moved out within a week, it would be reduced by a factor of 50. Your chance of cancer would go up from 20% to 20, less than 21%.
I have a question.
Yes.
So you say the chance of cancer goes up by a certain amount, but when you get cancer, don't you get it sooner if you're exposed to a radiological weapon? In other words, you're not going to get it when you're 80, you're going to get it.
Yeah, I believe the answer is no. At the Hiroshima, the number was recently raised from 1% to 1.5%, and this is based on recent cancers. What seems to happen is that the cancer... I don't really know the answer to your question, but I think the answer is that that hasn't been seen. Cancer requires more than one mutation. Most cancers require several. And so what this does is increases your chance of getting one of the bad mutations. But people have not... Anyway, so at least this extra 0.5% came just in the last 20 years from Hiroshima, which was over 50 years ago. Almost 60 years ago. No, 60 years ago.
Question?
Yes.
So you mentioned cleanup. Can this actually be cleaned up? Because, I mean, if I'm a terrorist, I can imagine that, you know, getting a million people to move out of an urban center might be very disruptive in certain ways. So
you're talking about 1 square kilometer here. In San Francisco, that's much less than a million.
Okay.
These are issues that I'm not really addressing here because they're ones that you can address as easily as I. I don't really want to try to give you the conclusions I've drawn. I'll do that every now and then. And in fact, I guess I was just giving you one. I was saying I wouldn't use it, and I was giving you the reasons why I wouldn't use it. I think the important thing for you to know is what the effect would be, and then you have to judge whether Al-Qaeda would do that yourself. The effect is not going to be lots of dead bodies. If you believe that Al-Qaeda, in order, well, for whatever reasons, maybe to look like he has really wreaked havoc on the U.S., more than just the economy, wants to show the dead bodies, this isn't going to give them to you. If you believe all he's really trying to do is to disrupt the economy of the U.S. and create fear, then this might be a good way to do it. So you have to take into account the psychology of Al-Qaeda. My own guess on that is that he needs to get bodies for recruitment purposes, but that's not something I really know a lot about. So this is the story on the radiological weapon. And let me just check over my notes and see what key things I haven't told you that I intended to. Now, I think I've covered most of my material. So I can solicit some questions. Yes.
Are there any heavy elements besides?
Go ahead.
Are there any heavy elements besides uranium and plutonium for which you could make a fission bomb?
Those are the only ones that people have tried to make a bomb out of ever. I don't know whether Livermore and Los Alamos may have some other things up their sleeves, but those are the only ones that have been used.
So Rich, you talked about in one of the articles we assigned whether Al Qaeda might have thought that these anthrax spores in a letter would mix easily with the air. Can you comment about what we know about the physics of mixing sort of an ideal anthrax weapon with air, and how reliable delivery is, where you see the strong and weak points of that kind of weapon?
Yeah, that's an interesting issue there. Let me draw your attention to that, since you mentioned that, about anthrax, because it has an interesting history. I do talk about this in one of the articles that I wrote. This is the key thing. Defense Research Establishment, a subfield. Whoops. I keep on pushing things I don't mean to push. Defense Research Establishment of Suffield, report number TR-2001-048. So you can search for that on the web. It's available. I have a website here, but no quick way of writing it down. This is a report published by Canada. Interestingly, it came out, was published on the web on September 1st, 2001. It was one of a whole series of discussions of anthrax that I found on the web. In fact, shortly after October of 2001, I went on the web to see what a terrorist could find out about anthrax. This was a really interesting report, because in this report, the government of Canada did a test to see what would happen. They came up with a scenario. Remember, this is before any anthrax had hit the U.S. They came up with a scenario that they thought a terrorist might do. So what they tried was what they called an envelope attack. So they took envelopes and they put a gram of anthrax spores in them, not real spores, these were killed spores. And they had a test building with a ventilation system, and they had someone open this thing and say, whoops, what is that? And then they went around to test to see how the spores got around. And it turned out they spread throughout the building, and they estimated that almost everybody in the building would have contracted anthrax. So it was a quite scary report. In fact, when I looked on the web to see what information was available on anthrax, the basic bottom line was anthrax is really a weapon we should be afraid of. It's a very dangerous thing. But these spores, they have to be the right size. If they clump up and they're more than a few microns in size, it turns out they don't get deep into the lungs where they need to get to. We may hear more about that. Will you be talking about that afterwards? Okay. So let me not go into a whole lot of detail on that. But in this report, it was on September 1st, and it painted a horrible picture of the dangers of anthrax. In fact, when I looked on the web in October, a month later, I found only horrible stories on the web about how dangerous anthrax would be. Then in October of 2001, people started opening up letters that had anthrax in them. And I'll leave most of that story for you. And it did not spread very much. Why not? Well, this isn't my story, but when done by amateurs, even using high-quality material, for some reason it didn't spread. So what is the future of anthrax? Is this something we should really fear about? I'll leave that for your presentation. The other thing people worry about is plutonium. Plutonium-239, I have a recording of Walter Cronkite saying this is the deadliest material known to man. In fact, if you break it up into anthrax-sized particles, 3 or 4 microns in size, if you disperse it through the air, like the anthrax terrorists failed to do, and breathe it in, it's very dangerous. If you eat it, it's not. And you get it on your skin, the radiation doesn't even get through the dead layer of your skin. It's alpha particles and it has a short range. The only danger of plutonium-239 is that you breathe it in. And people have worried about what happens if you get plutonium and you blow it up and you turn it into an aerosol of particles 3 microns in size, that these will float around in the air for maybe hours, people will breathe them in, and then the radioactivity from plutonium-239 makes it more effective than anthrax by a factor, I think, of something like between 10 and 100, something like that, as I recall. The experiments that have been done to do this have always failed. It doesn't mean it wouldn't happen by accident. But if you get the wrong size plutonium, it doesn't get deep in the lungs. And so I don't have really detailed knowledge of these experiments, but the bottom line that I have been told is that we are not aware of any way of aerosolizing this in such a way that it would be more dangerous than anthrax. Let me just leave it at that.
Any other questions?
We'll mention one thing, Jose Padilla. He was the, sometimes called the Chicago street thug, who got extensive training from Al-Qaeda, came to the U.S., decided to make a radiological weapon. Could he have done this? Well, he could have. He probably could have gotten hold of some medical material. Hard to do. And whether he had the savvy to be able to pull that off is not clear. My own guess is that he would not have succeeded in getting a hold of the radioactive material. People would have been suspicious, especially post-9/11. But according to the trial, he was told by Al-Qaeda to abandon that idea. And this, as I said in one of my articles, this scares me. He was told to abandon the idea. Instead, what he was told to do was to rent apartments in 2 apartment buildings and rig up a device such that he could turn on the natural gas in his apartment and then leave. And the apartment would fill up, both of them, with natural gas. And then after a certain period of time, maybe an hour, there would be a spark that would set off the natural gas and he would blow up and maybe burn down 2 apartment buildings. I find that to be a scary story. One, because it's so plausible that you could do that. And you start doing that, and it's not that hard to do. What's even scarier is that Al-Qaeda told them, don't bother with a radiological weapon. Do this instead. And I think they were right. I think they went from something which was exotic and probably wouldn't spread as much terror to something which was relatively straightforward, relatively simple, and where we are enormously vulnerable. Sometimes people ask me about attacking a nuclear power plant. I went to a tour of a nuclear power plant along with a group that was reviewing the terrorist response team to see how they would respond to a terrorist attack on the power plant. Without going into very much detail, there are vulnerable places in the nuclear power plant, especially where the waste is stored. Most of it's not in Yucca Mountain in Nevada. We're keeping it by the reactors because Yucca Mountain has not been approved yet as a place to store it. So mostly we're keeping it right next to our nuclear reactors. There are some vulnerabilities there, but as I left the plant after watching the terrorist team present them with different scenarios, look at the tests they did, I came away thinking, please, please, terrorist group, attack a nuclear power plant. Given all the other vulnerabilities we have in our society, like natural gas in apartment buildings, and I look, having spent a day looking at the protection that they have in the nuclear power plant, it is possible in principle for them to get in if they are super smart. If they have 10 people of the caliber of James Bond coming in, they could probably blow it up. But given the Jose Padillas of the world, I just hope that's the attack they choose instead of trying to blow up buildings in downtown using natural gas. Yes?
So given that you feel like there are a lot of really simple, low-tech attacks, what's the implication for what the government should do about it then?
Okay, the question, if you didn't hear it, is given the fact that there are low-tech attacks, what should the government do? Well, the government has been in a mixed mode. Much of what they did initially was done to calm U.S. fears. That means experts knew it had no effect whatsoever on any future terrorist attack, but it made people think that they were doing something. So, for example, most of the X-raying and things they're doing at airports, the only things I think that really count at the airport are looking for explosives coming on board. And there are good ways to detect explosives, not remotely, but you sniff them, and that's the only way we have that really works for detecting explosives. But, you know, the fact that I couldn't bring my pocket knife on board or even my nail clipper, that has no effect whatsoever. I think having vigilance is the most important thing. According to court documents, Osama bin Laden did want to buy a crop duster factory. A crop duster facility. Mohammed Atta came to the U.S., we now know, and went to the Department of Agriculture to try to get the U.S. to fund and pay for his crop duster facility that he wanted to buy. What was he going to do? Spread anthrax? My guess was that might have been one of the ideas, but the more likely thing is to fill it with gasoline and blow it into a building before he figured out how to do that with commercial airliners. So what do we do about these little threats? Nobody is going to buy a crop duster facility in the United States in the foreseeable future without the FBI knowing about it within an hour. The crop duster people are very aware of this. People worry about civil liberties when you're spying on your neighbors. But that's probably the best protection we have. There are very few neighborhoods in the U.S. where someone could start a major terrorist organization and not have it reported to the police. So the biggest thing we can do is good police work. You infiltrate the terrorist organizations. Al-Qaeda is enormously sensitive to infiltration. They operate on super secrecy. And they learned in the first bombing of the World Trade Center that they were almost infiltrated. That was almost stopped by people who had gotten information about it. So they keep themselves very thin, very lean, very few people. When Atta came over, there were people whose job it was to get him airplane tickets, but they had no idea what he was, where he was doing. All their job was to give him a place to stay and buy him airplane tickets. Super secrecy. Now, once you start having good police work, super secrecy becomes a real detriment to a terrorist organization. I believe that Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, the reason he went and tried to explode his shoe was that he hadn't gotten any word from Al-Qaeda. Blowing up one airplane, is that a terrorist event? I believe the shoe bombs were meant, this is a guess on my part, meant to be 10 different shoe bombs all going off at the same time. So why was there just one? My guess is because Richard Reid wasn't not a very smart guy. And he had been given this shoe thing, and he was willing to blow himself up, and then he didn't hear from anybody. Why didn't he hear from anybody? Well, because the FBI was bugging everybody's phone that they could think of and getting permission to do it. So nobody was making any phone calls. So he was sitting there not hearing anything. This is all speculation. And finally decided, hey, he wasn't going to wait. And he went and tried to blow up the plane himself, a single lone in the process, exposing the secret of Al-Qaeda that they had invented this clever shoe bomb. And that's why we check our shoes at airports, because my guess is there are more of those shoe bombs out there that haven't been used yet. But my point is that they depend on secrecy. And with good police work, it's very hard for them to operate within the United States. This is why I really expect the next terrorist events from Al-Qaeda not to be within the U.S., but to be outside. There are places around the world where we're far more vulnerable than we are here. That doesn't have the impact that an attack in the U.S. would have. So the lone person, if you can get someone who is smart enough to move in the U.S. without being noticed, if he buys up an airplane, DC-3 or something like that, knows how to fly it, is willing to commit suicide, they could still do something. But I think it's hard. You know, people say we're so vulnerable now because Al-Qaeda has shown they can use suicide bombers. And that's true. And I think the main thing we want to worry about are suicide bombers. But suicide bombers, they're much harder to get them. I mean, you know, you only get to use them once. Their best people were probably used. You have to have someone who is able to work within the United States, able to buy a DC-3 and not draw suspicion. Mohammed Atta, when he was here, preparing for this, you have to remember the time before 9/11. It was a time when people were mostly paranoid about ethnic profiling. There was a case at Los Alamos in which a scientist at Los Alamos was being investigated by the FBI, and the FBI was being raked over the coals because they had picked him because he was of Chinese descent. And because of that, the FBI was being punished. Before 9/11, just to finish the story, Mohammed Atta went to the Department of Agriculture, appeared before, what is her name? I think I have it here somewhere. She interviewed him to see whether he wanted to apply for money to buy a crop duster company. And when he discovered he was being interviewed by a woman, he refused to be interviewed at first because he's not going to be interviewed by a woman. Then he threatened her. And this is all on the record now. Something like that wasn't reported in the days before 9/11. These days, there's no way that wouldn't be known to the FBI within minutes. So it's much harder for them to operate in the U.S. And good police work, I think, is the key, not better, not high technology, better police work, basically. Okay, Steve?
All right, let's thank our speaker. Minutes and then we'll have another speaker for you.